Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest leaks from inside the secret Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal negotiations in Utah last November that were provided by WikiLeaks. Ilana Solomon, the director of the Responsible Trade Program at the Sierra Club, joins us to discuss the leaked TPP draft treaty chapter on the environment that indicates a weakening of environmental protections in exchange for increased trade among the parties in the negotiations: the United States, Japan, Mexico, Canada, Australia, Malaysia, Chile, Singapore, Peru, Vietnam, New Zealand, and Brunei. The rising Asian Pacific power, China, the world's fastest growing and second most powerful economy, is excluded from the deal. Then from This Company Town, we will assess this year's just announced Academy Awards nominations. One of the world's leading analysts on popular culture, media, and their connection to everyday life, Toby Miller, joins us to discuss this year's nominees in terms of their political content and how much they capture the current political zeitgeist. The most obvious at the top of the list with 10 nominations is American Hustle, which is based on the FBI abscam sting that bagged a bunch of crooked politicians. And with 6 nominations, Nebraska, a searing look at the fading and forlorn American dream in rural red state America. Then finally, we'll examine the paradox of the Iranian hardliners and hawks in a symbiotic alliance with the pro-war Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill, trying to scuttle the diplomatic opening with the just-concluded nuclear deal between the P5 plus one and Iran. Trita Parsi, the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran, joins us to discuss his article at Roll Call, Khamenei's Little Helpers in the Senate, and the president's impassioned plea to Democratic senators Wednesday evening in the White House not to sabotage his deal with Iran. Joining us now is Ilana Solomon, who's the director of the Responsible Trade Program at the Sierra Club, where she works to create public support for trade and investment rules to protect the environment and to shed light on the environmental threats posed by our current global trading system. Previously, she was a senior policy analyst with ActionAid USA. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ilana Solomon.
Thank you very much for having me, Ian.
And on Wednesday, WikiLeaks published a leaked draft of the environmental part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement that was negotiated, or at least the latest round were held in Salt Lake City, Utah, from November the 19th to the 24th. And this leak comes from that particular meeting, which, of course, is very secretive. But clearly somebody on the inside has been leaking stuff profusely to WikiLeaks. So what's your sense of what's going on here in the drama behind the scenes?
Great. That's a great question. Well, the first thing I would say is that we know very little about what's going on behind the scenes. As you noted, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement has been conducted in near complete secrecy. The negotiations have been going on for nearly 4 years now, and yet not a single word of draft text has intentionally been released by the governments. Not even, for example, U.S. government proposals are available to the public. So it's really tragic that we have to rely on WikiLeaks in order to provide the information that we need to know in order to understand what is going on. So the environment chapter text that leaked was the third leak that we've seen of a TPP chapter. And I think what's most notable is to compare how weak the environment chapter is as compared to the other two chapters, which protect corporate interests, which are very strong, legally enforceable, binding, that don't resemble at all the incredibly weak, sort of toothless language in the environment chapter.
And apparently somebody from either the United States, Japan, Mexico, Canada, Australia, Malaysia, Chile, Singapore, Peru, Vietnam, New Zealand, and Brunei, which are the countries involved in this new deal, is leaking this material to WikiLeaks, or perhaps more than one person's doing it. But my understanding of the TPP, just in broad strokes, is it's a part of President Obama's pivot to Asia. And in many ways, China's absence from the TPP seems to be pretty significant. And it feels in many ways that this is a sort of pact to exclude China as a growing global hegemon. Is that the way you see it?
So, you know, the United States has sort of talked out of both sides of its mouth on this issue. On the one hand, it's very clear that this is a pivot to Asia. That's what President Obama has stated, and some can certainly view it as sort of a policy to isolate China. And on the other hand, for example, last year, the United States Trade Representative Ron Kirk stated that he would like nothing more than to have China join the TPP. So, you know, clearly China is one of the biggest and most notable actors that is not currently in the agreement, although there was some rumor and speculation that it may join the agreement at some future time. And I think what's really important here is, again, right now the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement is between 12 countries, but it's known as what's called a docking station, so that any country in the Pacific Rim or potentially beyond could jump aboard and sign on to the TPP at nearly any time. So that certainly could include China, and a number of other countries have expressed interest as well. So this is just a growing, enormous trade pact, and its provisions on the environment, jobs, our economy, health, all are greatly impacted in this pact.
Well, I bring up China because this environmental chapter that was leaked by WikiLeaks, or to WikiLeaks, does cover issues like overfishing, trade of wool products, wildlife crime, and illegal logging. And my understanding is that the most prolific illegal loggers in the world are connected to the Chinese military, who, of course, have all kinds of proprietary business interests. You know, they sneak up river into Papua New Guinea that has a weak government, and a whole grove of ancient trees disappear in a day, and they're taken out by barge, and nobody knows about it until they see this great scar on the landscape. And this apparently goes on a routine basis. So that's why I'm wondering, if you're going to address environmental plunder, why not engage the biggest actor in environmental plunder?
Well, I think the real question is whether the TPP environment chapter is really going to contain environmental destruction. I mean, many of the countries in the TPP already, even without China, are still major importers and exporters of illegally harvested timber, wildlife, fish, and ostensibly the idea behind the environment chapter is to contain some of the damage that more trade could cause on the environment. The problem, though, as we've seen from this leaked text, is that the current status of the chapter is completely unacceptable and doesn't at all address the issues of, you know, forest depletion, wildlife trade, unsustainable fisheries management, because it lacks any enforcement mechanism. There's no real obligations for countries to uphold any of the commitments in the chapter, and it's full of really weak language and generalities. So I think the real question is how this environment chapter is going to be significantly strengthened while the countries have sort of a self-imposed deadline to finish the agreement in the next several months.
And again, I'm speaking with Alana Solomon, who's the director of the Responsible Trade Program at the Sierra Club, where she works to create public support for trade and investment rules that protect the environment and to shed light on the environmental threats posed by our current global trading system. Previously, she was senior policy analyst with ActionAid USA. Well, I would think that one of the problems here with getting some kind of consensus would be on the issues involved with climate change. After all, the new Australian Prime Minister is a climate change denier. He called climate change absolute crap. So what's your understanding of what negotiations are going on in that regard? Because, you know, the dynamic in the arguments over climate change, which we saw recently at the UN conference in Warsaw, is between the haves and the have-nots. And the have-nots are saying, you're the guys who put all this stuff up in the atmosphere in the first place, so don't punish us. And apparently Vietnam and Malaysia are concerned about impositions on their burning of fossil fuels. And yet you've got a have country like Australia, which has the worst global warming footprint per capita in the world, whose leader now denies its very existence.
Yes, so the climate change section of the leaked text is one that is in complete disarray, it seems like. First of all, it's full of very weak language. For example, parties, quote, recognize the desirability that trade and climate change policies be mutually supportive. And that's the type of weak language that we see throughout this pact, recognize the desirability or strive to achieve or endeavor to cooperate. So it's already quite a weak section. But the text also reveals that both the United States and Australia, as you mentioned, cannot agree to the article as currently drafted. And my sense is that it's not that they can't agree because it's too weak, but the sense is that they can't agree because it's too strong, which is a pretty sad statement. I would also flag another section, piece of the climate change text that has a very weak, once again, sort of quasi-commitment to have countries phase out subsidies to fossil fuels like coal, oil, and gas, but rather than actually requiring countries to eliminate fossil fuels to these polluting industries, instead it just recognizes previous commitments and encourages cooperation on this round. And there's still a host of countries, including Vietnam, Malaysia, Peru, that don't even agree once again to that very weak language.
So what's your sense then of whether or not the drip, drip, drip of these leaks from whoever among the countries that I mentioned in the TPP are leaking this information to WikiLeaks? It is, of course, putting the very fast-track ability of the Obama administration in jeopardy, is it not? More and more Congress people, first of all, they're not happy about the idea that they're cut out of the loop to begin with. And as these leaks come out, as they have done, as you mentioned, this is the third set of leaks. I would think that pressure is building against the White House, is it not?
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of frustration, both from the Congress and from members of the public, that they have been, you know, largely excluded from the negotiation process. Members of the public have been completely shut out. Members of Congress have only, like in the very recent past, started to be able to see parts of the agreement. But I think there is incredible frustration mounting and growing that this agreement has been negotiated in such secrecy and that we have to rely on the few leaked texts that are available in order to get real information.
So when do you think the straw will break the camel's back?
It's hard to say exactly. I mean, I think the biggest debate right now and the most important moment right now we have to gain some control over this negotiation process is through a process in the United States called Fast Track. And basically, just last week, there was a piece of legislation introduced in both our House of Representatives and the Senate that would allow the president to continue, if Fast Track were approved, would allow the president to continue negotiating in the executive branch of the agreement, allow the president to sign the TPP, and then hand it to Congress for limited debate, no amendments, and a simple up or down vote. And I think this is going to be really crucial. The Sierra Club strongly opposes Fast Track legislation because we do not believe that Congress should give up its ability to essentially ensure that the contents of trade agreements actually protect the public and the environment. So I think this is going to be a really critical moment, whether Congress gives the president Fast Track authority. And we, as the Sierra Club and many of our allies, are strongly opposing Fast Track and encourage listeners to call their member of Congress right now and urge your member to oppose fast-tracking the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
And again, I'm speaking with Alana Solomon, the director of the Sierra Club's Responsible Trade Program. But I suppose just fundamentally, the question that we should be asking and that should be answered, not that it's likely to happen with these secret negotiations underway, but if the purpose of the TPP and this trade agreement is to foster more trade, how do you increase trade, which by implication means more industrial activity, at the same time decrease environmental destruction? Because they go hand in hand, do they not?
Well, I think that is why the Sierra Club has been really opposed to the current model of free trade. It's not that we're against trade, because we do actually think that you can trade responsibly, but you need to have the right rules in place that could potentially set limits on trade, ensure that trade is legal. Another issue that we follow closely is trade in fossil fuels, and we oppose the idea that countries, you know, should be trading, that the United States should be exporting our natural gas, coal, and oil. We're trying to stop exports of fossil fuels from the United States. But you're right, that is quite counter to the current free trade ideology, which is sort of put forward in agreements like the TPP, which is about removing government regulation rather than ensuring that trade happens responsibly with the proper oversight and with the proper regulations.
And in terms of wildlife destruction, I recall very recently seeing pictures of a vast cache of ivory being destroyed. I'm not sure that it was in China or perhaps it was in Taiwan. Who are the worst actors in this regard? Not so much at the poaching end in Africa, where we're learning now that elephants are endangered, and we're also learning that lions are endangered. So if you're going to stop it, I mean, let's face it, the model for the war on drugs is to go after the drug lords, while the customers here in the United States who fund and continue this problem are largely untouched, and not that they ever get the drug lords to begin with. So is there a similar model going on here that, you know, the focus is on trying to stop the poachers rather than the end users who are fairly easily identified?
Yeah. So I think, you know, clearly, ideally, what we have to do is stop both. For one example, and this has to do with the illegal timber trade, the United States, and this is an example of a good trade policy, has a law in place called the Lacey Act. And it's a law that bans the import to the United States of illegally harvested plants and plant products, and also bans the imports of illegally taken wildlife. So we have to stop the demand and the imports of, you know, illegally harvested timber, wildlife, fish, and then we also, of course, have to address the problem in forest-producing countries or the countries where poaching and other illegal activity is happening. Again, as you increase trade, if you don't have the proper regulations in place, then you're also going to increase illegal trade, which means more wildlife poaching and trade, more unsustainable fisheries management and trade, more trade in illegally harvested timber, which is why it's so critical to actually regulate trade and get these rules right.
So, Ilana Solomon, I recall a few years ago, I can't remember who it was I interviewed, I think it was somebody from either Greenpeace or Rainforest Action, that didn't a group of environmentalists board a ship that was carrying illegally harvested timber to the United States? And I believe the United States charged them with piracy. Do you remember that?
I don't have the specifics on that. I'm sorry.
Right. But I wondered whether that led to the Lacey Act.
No, the Lacey Act was, it's a century-old piece of legislation in 1900. It was amended in 2008 to ban the import of illegally harvested timber.
I see. How robust, then, are the, at least, the laws at this end here in the United States about illegal timber, illegal products from poached wildlife, etc.?
Yeah. Well, I think there are, you know, there are international treaties that the United States has signed on to that prohibit, you know, imports of illegally taken wildlife and forests, and the Lacey Act is a very effective U.S. law that could use additional funding and support to be truly effective and ensure that importers, you know, face the proper penalties, fines, potentially criminal action if they are caught importing illegally harvested timber. And the idea in a trade agreement could be that that type of regulation that exists in the United States, Australia actually has a similar piece of legislation, that countries could be required to take similar action in their domestic circumstances. The problem is that this leaked text has a provision that commits countries to put in place measures that allow it to take action to stop imports of illegal flora and fauna, but does not require them to do so.
Well, just in closing, Ilana Solomon, could this be better addressed, or could it be addressed at a cultural level? In other words, take away the incentive for people in the first place to buy ivory products, or in particular, rhino horns, which are supposedly an aphrodisiac and apparently are not. I mean, why not give these people Viagra instead? I mean, do you know what I'm saying?
I would just say, I think, you know, right now, in the context of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, the most important thing we could do is make sure that, you know, it's done right or it's not done at all. We have no indication that the rules in this agreement are actually going to protect the environment. The most important thing we can do right now is ensure that Congress maintains its ability to have oversight over trade negotiations, to amend, if necessary, trade agreements, to prevent a really flawed pact from coming into place.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Ilana Solomon.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Alana Solomon, who's the director of the Responsible Trade Program at the Sierra Club, where she works to create public support for trade and investment rules that protect the environment and to shed light on the environmental threats posed by our current global trading system. Previously, she was senior policy analyst with ActionAid USA. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the Academy Awards nominations.
All things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Oh, mercy, mercy me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from London is Toby Miller, who was recently a Professor of Cultural Industries at the City University of London, and prior to that, the Director of the UC Studies Center in Mexico City and Chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. Toby Miller is one of the world's leading analysts on popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. His books include Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Capture the Cultural Politics of Television, and How We Can Take It Back, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, Greening the Media, and Blowing Up the Humanities. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Miller.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And the Academy Awards nominations have just been announced, and you're there in London, and I'm sorry that to pry you away from the pub, but I wanted to get a perspective of somebody that's outside of the country, because in many ways, the American movies or Hollywood movies are one of America's most powerful exports, and in terms of what they call soft power, the influence of Hollywood is immense. And many people, for example, attribute the end of the Cold War to rock and roll and movies, not how many nuclear missiles the Russians and the Americans had pointed at each other. So with that in mind, do you see a change in the culture, if you will, of the Motion Picture Academy and its members?
Well, Ian, you raised so many good points in your question. Going back to the soft power issue, I've always thought this was a slightly embarrassing, rather penile metaphor. But Joe Nye, NYE, who was, of course, a Clinton official in Bill Clinton's presidency and is a noted international relations academic whose work you know well, was the person who coined this expression to say that the obvious power that comes from commercial and military authority and advantage is sometimes buttressed and, in fact, sometimes almost insignificant next to the power of what's sometimes called public diplomacy, or what the United States likes to imagine is person-to-person interaction, where a citizen of one country engages a citizen of another, regardless of the power of the state or anybody else. But, of course, the U.S. always wants this to be done in a way that suits its international agenda of both its military and its commercial wings. Well, in the case of Hollywood, really, although nowadays there's a lot of talk about the importance of this international market, which means outside the U.S. and Canada, Canada is regarded rather patronizingly as domestic for the purposes of Hollywood revenues, the international market's been absolutely crucial for over 60 years, and it becomes more and more so with the Internet and the requirement to release things almost on the day that they become available in the United States all over the world. When it comes to the Academy itself and what it decides to nominate, there are, in terms of English language movies, there are really only a couple of possibilities for what wins each year as Best Picture. It still tends to be a raft of movies, mostly not action adventure, mostly not comedies, made by the Hollywood studios that are the preferred nominees, and then there'll generally be one movie maybe made in Britain that is the alternative. And so, you know, the big kind of hit pick as a possible alternative this year is 12 Years a Slave, which is a black British film. about the appalling history of the Black Atlantic slave trade. But whether the Academy itself is really changing, that's a question we get asked on a regular basis. It's still dominated by the people who dominate the running of Hollywood itself, both in the studios and across the guilds.
Well, one of the things, though, about the Academy's awards ceremony itself is that it's often a sort of accidental venue, if you will, for political outbursts, more often than not from the left. And, you know, sometimes one waits through these interminable ceremonies on television in the hope that somebody's going to say something either real, relevant, or incendiary.
Well, this probably goes back most memorably to The Godfather, the first Godfather picture, when Marlon Brando refused to appear to accept the Academy Award as Best Actor. And a Native American woman agreed to speak for him and to speak about the oppression of indigenous peoples by U.S. domestic imperialism. And, of course, since then, we've had a number of other interventions. Sometimes they're regarded as fairly benign. So, for instance, around the late 80s and early 90s, there was lots of discussion of the need for public policy movement in the treatment of HIV and AIDS. And people wore ribbons about it and spoke about it in speeches at the Oscars. That wasn't terribly controversial. But when you had Susan Sarandon and Tim Robbins speaking out about the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, when you had Michael Moore speaking out against the George W. Bush administration, then there were some very negative responses. Years ago, back in the 70s again, when Vanessa Redgrave spoke out about the plight of the Palestinian people, some very negative responses. So there can be these enlivening moments, these extraordinary moments, as with the Palestinian protest, as with the Native American one. And there can also be a sense of just liberal Hollywood patting itself on the back, which you got a bit, I think, with HIV and AIDS. But whether there'll be any kind of protest remark this time remains to be seen. I'm not quite sure what topic it might take. Liberal Hollywood is always very proud of its environmental record. It'd be nice to see some people making a protest about the environmental despoliation involved in the motion picture and television industries, which is appalling, and in the Southern California area is responsible for, it's said by some experts, greater pollution than any other industry, including aerospace and the car industries. But I doubt that will happen, frankly. I don't think we quite have the cause, and I don't think we have the preparedness to tie things into criticizing the industry itself. What we might also hope to see, of course, is some critique of how the Academy goes about its voting, which remains quite arcane. At times has seen bodies like the Internal Revenue Service get involved because it seemed to be, if not corrupt, I don't think that would be a fair word to use, then at least something where favors are encouraged as a consequence of gifts. And the IRS has wanted to see that counted against people's income for tax purposes. I don't see any major reform of how the Academy goes about its business. It remains a day of self-congratulation, reaching out to the globe and to the United States in particular and saying, aren't we wonderful?
Well, of course, if the IRS is looking for favors and swag and gifts and payback and payola or plugola, they don't have to go further than the Golden Globes or even worse, the People's Choice Awards on CBS, which, interestingly enough, everybody that wins happens to be the only person that's in the room.
Well,
coincidence.
With the Golden Globes, they've been the butt of many jokes over the years, and there are some very serious people who are members of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the entity that votes for the Golden Globes, but certainly they are not perhaps regarded as having the same stature as the Oscars. And of course, in many cases, the Oscars, most of them are for very technical skills, and they're voted for by people who are real masters of their craft and art, and they're taken very seriously. And I don't wish to suggest for a moment that they're simply bought, but it is true that there was a period in the 90s and the early noughties when magnificent hampers full of champers and clothes and jewels and who knows what would appear at people's houses along with DVDs of the movies that studios were promoting in the hope that they would get nominated or voted for. And I think that's what alerted the IRS to this boondoggle, this problem. Mm. But I think there's a wider issue here, which, to get back to your question about soft power and hard power, which is the extent to which Hollywood matters around the world and why it matters. People like you and me, Ian, are probably prone to saying this is about the way in which the United States government and commerce operates effectively to control the distribution of motion picture and television drama entertainment. But for most critics, and for most folks perhaps, it's all about, well, they've got the best pictures, or they've got the best stories, or they spend the most money, so it's the most entertaining. And that's all that Hollywood means. It's just entertainment and fun. And one of the tasks for those of us who think that something more is being sold than simply 2 hours of entertainment is to show why the 2 hours of entertainment has the effect that it has in terms of people's views of questions of gender and race and class and imperialism, but also to show that some of the reason for Hollywood's success is not just the quality and the capacity of its artists, the quality and capacity that I don't doubt, but much more to do with the very hard power of U.S. militarism and commercial authority buttressing the export and import of Hollywood product.
And again, I'm speaking with Toby Miller, who's in London. He was recently the Professor of Cultural Industries at the City University of London, and prior to that, the Director of the UC Studies Center in Mexico City and Chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. Toby Miller is one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. And his books include Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Capture the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, Greening the Media, and Blow Up the Humanities. And in terms of, you mentioned how the movie industry is detrimental to the environment here in Southern California. Explain that.
Well, think about in terms of production, and there may be listeners who were intimately involved in the production of Hollywood cinema and television, the amount of carbon footprint that we generate when we drive trucks or cars to venues. Think about the amount of electricity, much of it powered by carbon, that we utilize, we draw upon at every point from pre-production through production and post-production. As consumers, think about the amount of electricity that we use when we turn on our televisions or our computers, or the amount of carbon that footprint that we generate when we drive to the movie theater. Think about the waste that of packaging and so on that is part of everything from tickets through to popcorn holders. Put all that together and you have a quite remarkable impact on our environment. Now, to be fair, most of the major movie studios and many of the film commissions around the world that facilitate Hollywood have green production guides. And everyone from Time Warner through to Sony talk a good game about trying to green Hollywood. But the fact is that all the devices that you and I are talking through, that people are listening through now, are themselves the product of, frankly, very ecologically unsustainable practices, all the way from mining the various minerals that go into these products through to how they are powered, how we receive and transmit information across them, and so on. So it's one of these things where you have to think about the entire commodity sign, the commodity sign that is your favorite reality TV show or your favorite movie, and say, what actually went in terms of natural resources and unnatural resources, the making of that, the transmission of that, the reception of that? What part did I play as an audience member? What part did you play as a producer?
Well, while our audience is trying to absorb their personal responsibility for the planet here, let's go back to the handicapping here of Hollywood with these nominations that just came out from the Academy. And just in terms of an earlier question about whether or not the voting pool, the Academy members are exhibiting some change. It's notable that both Robert Redford and Tom Hanks, who of course have, you know, long-standing Hollywood credits, did not get nominations for Oscar nominations for their performances, where a group of younger actors certainly did. And, of course, the actor in the 12 Years a Slave also is in that group. So what do you make of that? Is that some kind of indication of a cultural shift?
Well, it is remarkable that Tom Hanks wasn't nominated because he has been very successful as a lead actor in the past and, of course, has won Best Actor a couple of times. It's also remarkable that Robert Redford wasn't nominated because it is a remarkable and extraordinary performance. I wouldn't say that it's all about going for youth because dear old Bruce Dern got the nod for Nebraska. And he makes you and me look like spring chickens, Ian.
By the way, did that film, I saw it. It's in black and white. I found that to be intensely political because I always, mm-hmm. That's my kind of cross to bear, if you will. I tend to be interested in political aspects of things. And, of course, there's the old saying, art ends where politics begins. But I thought that film was really an indictment of, red state America. It's almost as if red state America is a dead zone in that movie. It was quite disturbing.
No, I think that's absolutely true. And you think back to the Bruce Springsteen record of maybe 15 years ago in Nebraska, where there's a love for that area, but also a sense of intense desolation and hopelessness. Think of the music, too, of John Cougar Mellencamp talking about life in the upper Midwest, the Midwest in general, and what that can mean. But I think you're right. In terms of the sort of changes, I suppose that for me, we'll know there's been some kind of shift, at least an attitudinal one, if 12 Years a Slave is extremely successful, particularly if it wins Best Picture, because it is excoriating, relentless, remorseless in its pursuit of some profound truths about the slave trade and about the mistreatment of Africans by it. And I think that, if we see that winning for Steve McQueen as director, if we see that winning Best Picture, then part of that will be about the idea that, well, if it's vaguely British, then we're allowed to vote for it. But part of it will also be trying to confront the question of racism at the core of American life. And to me, that will be the most exciting element. If American Hustle wins everything, or The Wolf of Wall Street, to me, that's just one more year in the Oscars, and no one will remember it 5 minutes later.
Well, in terms of slavery, though, I mean, it's in the DNA of our politics. I mean, it's still in the South, in the sense not it's not practiced anymore, but it still shapes the politics. The Republican Party is a Southern party. It's a Confederate party, if you will. We have a kind of new feudalism in the South, and Wall Street and American capitalism is moving to the South. That is their preferred model, as opposed to the North, the Union, where people belong to unions. In the South, they're right-to-work states. So I think the legacy of slavery is not just historical. It's cultural and it's political and, more importantly, it's economic.
Oh, you're absolutely correct. And this goes back to two key events in U.S. history. One is a century after the end of the Civil War, when Lyndon Baines Johnson signed the major civil rights legislation in 64-65 that changed so much of the landscape of the country, and famously said, well, I'm signing away a Democratic majority for decades. And the other major event just a few years later is Richard Milhouse Nixon in 1968 in the presidential election campaign adopting what was called the Southern Strategy. And this was picking up on exactly what Johnson had realized, namely that the Dixiecrats, the far-right racist white men who formed the majority for the Democratic Party in the South over really a century, were being alienated and sent off to the Republican Party by the decision as a consequence of human rights campaigns, social movements, and a lot of white men, frankly, changing their minds in favor of civil rights for African Americans and full citizenship for African Americans. And the Southern Strategy that Nixon adopted in 68 is really what won him that election, and it's what won him re-election in 72, and it's what won Reagan his elections. Namely, we will seek to win over the white working class in sufficient numbers, along with people who directly benefit from the oppression of African Americans and other working class people of color, by telling them that it is cultural matters and civil rights questions that have held back their own advancement and their success, and they should resent those who receive either forms of direct economic welfare or who receive opportunities hitherto denied them by the system as a consequence of legislation and public policy. And that has continued to be at the core of the Republican Party's mission. There is absolutely no doubt about that. And of course, tied to that is also massive investment by the Pentagon in key southern states where there is very little private investment often that is not tied to Pentagon military expenditure. And hence, a whole set of local Congress people whose re-election is tied again and again and again and again to being able to bring home the bacon from the Pentagon and provide so-called private sector jobs, as I say, that are in fact part of corporate welfare. So, you know, that system remains extremely strong. The southern strategy that Nixon enunciated is really the only strategy the Republican Party has.
Well, just in closing, Toby Miller, in terms of the best pictures, you mentioned 12 Years a Slave, and we talked about Nebraska. The Dallas Buyers Club, of course, was a film about HIV/AIDS, which was a forbidden subject for a long time in Hollywood. But the one that looks like it might win and has certainly got the most nominations is American Hustle, and that's loosely about the Abscam scandal in the 70s in Washington, D.C. I think in many ways that film touched into the current zeitgeist about America's disgust with politicians and with Congress in particular.
I think you're right, and David O. Russell is a very, very competent filmmaker, and he has an excellent cast in American Hustle. And there's no doubt that Hollywood, you know, I've said some very critical things about it during this discussion, has always been prepared to, going back to the 30s and all the way through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, engage the question of corruption in D.C. and in political circles, also juridical circles, and corporate ones as well. And I think that, you know, this is something, as you say, that relates to the sense of alienation many of us feel in the United States. The key thing for the left, it seems to me, is to tap into the understandable anti-statism that is powerful across the U.S., but not accept it on its own terms, and instead try to tie it into seeing how anti-statism is, in fact, really, in most people's cases, about being poorly served by government. So we need motion pictures that don't say the state is irredeemable and evil, but instead give us, in addition to critiques, uplifting stories of where government can really make a difference in a democratic way.
Well, Toby Miller, I thank you so much for joining us here.
A pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Toby Miller, who is in London. He was recently a professor of cultural industries at the City University of London, and prior to that, the director of the UC Studies Center in Mexico City and chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. Toby Miller is one of the world's leading analysts on popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. And his books include Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Captured the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back, Makeover Nation, the United States of Reinvention, Greening the Media, and Blow Up the Humanities. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about President Obama's plea to the Democratic senators not to sabotage the diplomatic breakthrough with Iran. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Trita Parsi, a co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. His latest article at Roll Call is Khamenei's Little Helpers in the Senate. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Trita Parsi.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And the president met Wednesday night in the White House with a group of U.S. senators, and apparently he made a very impassioned plea to them not to sabotage the opening with Iran. Did it fall on deaf ears, do you know?
Actually, no. The meeting was very successful, according to one of the lawmakers who attended, who I spoke to. The president was very convincing. Amongst the Democrats already by that stage, more and more people had realized that the path that the president is on is successful, is constructive, it's working, and the worst thing they could do right now is to try to impose new sanctions that would sabotage it, and that would create very significant problems because the whole issue would be set back several years.
But my understanding is that there are 58 senators who already co-sponsored this bill that would sabotage the deal.
That is true. There are 58 co-sponsors to that bill. 15 or so of them are Democrats. And they needed about 60 co-sponsors in order to force Harry Reid to put it on the floor. They did not manage to reach that point. There are now more Democratic senators who have come out and said that they do not support it. Moreover, which is very interesting, several of the Democrats who have come out in support of it have also started to say that they do not see the need for this bill to be put on the floor right now. So as of right now, for this moment, the president has essentially won this, and this bill will not be coming to the floor anytime soon. That does not mean, however, that those who are seeking to impose new sanctions, which in my view they're primarily doing because they are trying to sabotage diplomacy, that they have given up. They will be trying new things very shortly, and at the slightest indication of a setback in the diplomacy, they will be there very quickly to try to declare it dead and move on towards other options.
So, Trita Parsi, did the very, very universal condemnation from the major editorials in the major newspapers like the New York Times and Los Angeles Times, etc., and some of the prominent columnists, including pro-Israel columnists like Jeffrey Goldberg, did that have any effect, do you think?
All of these things combined have had effect. I mean, of course, one of the most important things that happened is the fact that the interim agreement's implementation treaty also was concluded. Essentially, Iran and the other countries have agreed upon a schedule on how to implement the agreement that they already came to an agreement on in November. That was a huge plus as well, because essentially by this coming Monday, the Iranians are going to start to roll back certain parts of their nuclear program. With the president being able to say that to these lawmakers, that's a very powerful argument. Makes it much more difficult to claim that there's a need for additional sanctions.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Trita Parsi, the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. His latest article at Roll Call is Khamenei's Little Helpers in the Senate. Let's talk about your article, Khamenei's Little Helpers in the Senate, and about this sort of paradox of an apparent Iranian, a sort of symbiotic alliance, if you will, between Iranian hardliners and hawks and pro-war Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill. Just explain it, if you will, your thesis.
Well, what I was arguing for in that article in Roll Call was to point out that the hardliners in Iran and Khamenei himself are probably secretly rooting for Senator Kirk and Menendez to succeed with their push for sanctions. And the reason for that is that they were never inclined to go down this path of diplomacy that Rouhani now is pursuing. They had to abide by it because at the end of the day, Rouhani won the elections very convincingly. The population is with him right now, so that he has momentum. But Khamenei has managed to turn it into a win-win. By playing nice right now, he will declare victory if diplomacy succeeds. If diplomacy fails, however, particularly if it fails because members of Congress are creating unnecessary problems for it, essentially the reason it failed is because of the U.S., not because of Iran, then he will gain significantly, both internationally, because a lot of countries will feel that the U.S. is at fault, and as a result, they will stop implementing the sanctions. And as a result, Iran will get sanctions relief without giving a single nuclear concession. Moreover, internally inside the country, he will be able to point to Rouhani and them and say, see, I knew this was not going to work. You were naive to think that you could negotiate with the Americans. The Americans never keep their word. It's their fault that diplomacy failed right now. And from now on, we're going to deal with America my way, not your way.
So
from his perspective, if it fails as a result of American foul play, then he actually turns into a winner.
And you're satisfied that Khamenei was actually forced to accept Rouhani, that this was because of an enormous popular will shown in the elections, and he wasn't able to obviously rig the elections like they did with Ahmadinejad. Obviously, he didn't want to go through anything like that. So give us a sense of how, because most people don't follow the nuances of Iranian politics.
Sure. So there's been what I would actually call a bit of a conspiracy theory, which has said that, you know, Khamenei permitted Rouhani to win the elections. And, you know, it really fits well with the definition of a conspiracy theory because there's no evidence for what they're saying, but rather there's an assumption that Khamenei is the most powerful element in Iran. Anything that happens is a result of Khamenei wanting it. So whatever would happen in the elections, clearly that was because Khamenei wanted it. I don't think that is the case. I don't think Khamenei has that type of a control over the country, nor does he have the ability to decide things in this manner. And that was very, if you just follow Iranian politics, it's quite clear that Khamenei does not have that type of a control. And I think what you saw in the elections was that once the population realized that the regime had actually become quite weak internally as a result of the internal infighting that had been taking place between Khamenei, the Ahmadinejad factions, some of the other conservatives, that it meant that the regime simply could not afford trying to cheat again, because if they did, they would actually risk the complete collapse of the regime. As a result, if the population participated in the elections, they could actually force their will onto the regime without the regime being able to cheat and change the results. And that's part of the reason why you saw in the last couple of days of the elections, suddenly this massive mobilization in favor of Rouhani. Everyone knew that it's not difficult for the reformists and the pragmatic elements to win the election as long as the population decides to participate in the elections. The only way the conservatives tend to win elections in Iran is either by making sure that the population does not turn out and vote or by cheating it by other means. But when the population actually turns up to the ballot boxes, then they tend to vote for the most pragmatic voices that are on the ballots. And that's exactly what happened this time. People realized the regime could not afford to cheat, and as a result, they went out, voted for Rouhani, and now Khamenei is forced to deal with the policies, at least at this stage, that Rouhani is pushing for. This can change very quickly, as I mentioned, based on what he can deliver, what he doesn't deliver, and particularly if it turns out that diplomacy doesn't work out, well, then Khamenei can turn around and say, well, you had your chance, now it's back to my way.
And as you point out, if the U.S. sabotages this deal, the sanctions regime will collapse because other members of the P5+1 will basically say, well, the Americans screwed this and we don't have to abide by the sanctions anymore. So, but when you just said...
I don't think all of the sanctions would collapse, but a big portion of them would collapse.
Sure.
A lot of countries are very unhappy with the sanctions. It's costing them a lot of money.
Right, China in particular, right. Yeah,
and they agreed to that because there was a sense that the Iranians were at fault because Obama tried diplomacy in 2009 and it didn't work. And the general consensus was that it was the fault of Ahmadinejad. And they agreed to it. But if it now turns around, and actually diplomacy did work up until the U.S. Senate sabotaged it, and they're not going to continue to agree to pay this heavy economic price for a problem that actually already got resolved.
Well, just in the last minute, Trita Parsi, I don't understand why it is that obviously Israel is involved with this, and we just learned that Hillary Clinton apparently was suggesting in one of the deliberations over whether or not Israel would strike Iran that maybe we should let Israel to do it. So we know that Israel, behind, with using AIPAC, the lobby, is pretty much behind this effort in the Senate. And if they were to win, I think it would probably actually backfire with the American people because it's so flagrant that a foreign country is dictating U.S. foreign policy. And furthermore, you just pointed out that the public in Iran is unhappy with this government. Surely the best way to get rid of this government is through more contact with the outside world, which will weaken them. The one thing that would strengthen Khamenei would be an attack from either Israel or America or both.
Oh, absolutely. If there is an attack, particularly now when the population tends to be quite happy with the government of Rouhani, they feel that it's much more competent, it's handling foreign policy much better. Under those circumstances, you would see a much stronger rallying around the flag effect if there was an attack. It is indeed very problematic. And I think one of the reasons why a lot of members of Congress woke up, why the public is waking up to this as well, is because the White House actually went out and said very clearly in a statement, if some members of Congress want a war with Iran, why don't they just come out and say it up front instead of hiding behind some of these ideas that they put forward as a motivating factor for their sanctions? That was a very, very tough call. And the effect of it, I think, actually has been quite positive for the administration because they have managed to frame this issue exactly as it is. This is about either making peace with Iran or going to war with Iran.
Well, Dr. Trita Parsi, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Trita Parsi, who's a co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. His latest article at Roll Call is Khamenei's Little Helpers in the Senate. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Much